On today's Compassion Radio.
I come from a long line of Appalachian people who are very proud, but very caring. My granny Leona was one of the kindest, most Christian women I've ever met. Even though as a crippled woman, she wasn't going to church. She had no way to get there. She began each day with that Bible on her lap and with the name of Jesus on her lips.
Hi, friends, and welcome to today's Compassion Radio. Here's the question we'll start with today. Who are your heroes? Sports figures? Politicians? Musicians or movie stars, maybe? Or are they more personal to you? I believe the heroes who have the most impact on our lives are the ones we know personally, whose values trickle down into our souls, sometimes through the cracks and fissures of our lives, the places that seem ugly or broken to us. As our guest says today, the kind of people who love us to Jesus. There's no doubt that we need heroes, but we need to also remember that they can never replace the foundational relationship with our true hero and the ultimate truth teller, God Himself. This hero has made a profound impression on one hurting young lady, as you'll hear today. Thanks for joining us. Friends on Compassion Radio today, I'm happy to introduce an author that we've been pursuing for the past couple of weeks. Interesting story to tell, and some great books she's been working on. We'll get to that later in the program, but first, an introduction to Karen Spears Zacharias. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
You've been prolific with your blogging and with your recent writing. You're doing interesting Christian-themed novels that are not just genre. But it seemed like you are kind of rooted in your writing down in the Southeast, maybe Appalachia. Tell me a little bit, first of all, about the kind of books you write.
So I've done several nonfiction and several fiction books. The nonfiction work has been with Zondervan, so definitely from a Christian perspective. My novels are based in what I would consider a mercy vein. I write about the ability of community to heal people. We have the power of community to bring healing and grace. We don't always do that, but I've seen that in action in my own life, so I write to that.
And that's precisely why you and I are talking today, because there was a big dollop of that theme, of that ethic, in one of your blogs that I read recently. If there's ever been a time, I think, that especially the church community needs to be reminded, not just of their better angels, but how to find their way back to the throne of grace and how to act as God's hands of mercy and compassion, it's got to be now. There's a lot of people that are hurting because of things they believed, things that they have chosen to believe and realize they shouldn't have. And I'm not just talking about politics. I'm just saying that there's so much confusion about how to deal with unexpected hurt and pain in this world that our generation right now doesn't know how to process it. That's my impression. And so there's been not a whole lot of help, even from the pulpits, about how to deal with unexpected grief. And there's been plenty of that. The entire world right now is being traumatized, and not just by the pandemic. So healing communities really resonated with me. But let's go back to the beginning of the story here a bit. You were very entrenched in a zealot culture within evangelicalism back in the 80s. I understand heavily involved with the Moral Majority and a lot of the politics that go with that. You found yourself in a place of real influence as a writer. So tell me about the things you were writing back then and who you wrote for.
Back in the 80s, I'd really begun doing some writing on my own. So I was working with Home Life Magazine, Southern Baptist Magazine, and also Power for Living. I did some writing for them. It was out of that growth of writing that the editor at the local newspaper, who was a friend of mine, had called me one day and said, "We're short staff. Can you come work for us?" And I just laughed and said, "You know, I grew up in Georgia. I can't spell, I'm pretty sure."
You know, Grammarly was not an option back then.
Yeah. Exactly. And he said, well, come work for us. I'll teach you how to do this journalism gig.
Karen, I'm going to assume that when you started doing this, the last thing on your mind was that you would be stepping outside of your evangelical bubble to do this job. But what was the shift like reporting things that were not just about Christian issues or Christian themes?
It was quite a shift for me. My very first major, what we call in the journalism field, above the fold article, was a story about a woman I knew from church whose sister had been a Charles Manson follower. I had heard her testimony at church, and I had gone to her and said, you know, I'd like to write this for the newspaper, because if your sibling is a follower of cult leader, then prompts you toward violence, you can imagine the dysfunction that then occurs in a family. And her whole testimony had been about how it had taken her over a decade to learn to forgive her sister for her involvement in that cult, which then had prompted her father's heart attack and death and all kinds of family fallout from that.
Yeah.
So I had asked her if she would be willing to make that a public story. She agreed with one caveat, which was that we not take out any of her reference to Jesus. So I had gone to my editor and said, I have this great story to tell about forgiveness. Love to write it for the newspaper, but we can't perform what is commonly called a godectomy.
Yes, exactly. You know, I'll say faithectomy, yes.
We had to leave the God stuff in. He agreed, and it was a huge hit in the community. The community as a whole, Christian or non-Christian, responded so positively to it, because who among us hasn't had someone, some area of our life where we've needed to find grace and forgiveness?
Yeah. Who has? That's a rhetorical question, of course, but sometimes we need to be faced with those again at times when we are pretty much consumed with how we feel and forget what we need. That's a good question. What came out of that particular article?
So what happened from that, of course, is I became known among the community as that Christian writer.
Oh, there you go.
Even though I was a journalist.
Right.
And reporting on the cop beat, covering murders and education and, you know, all those general areas. These were really the heydays of local newspapers, not like what we're dealing with today. And I was entrenched at that time in the evangelical culture.
Yeah.
I was a mother to four kids and desperately wanting to raise them uprightly. I was an advocate for James Dobson, read all of his books, tried to apply that to my own raising of my children. But what began this shift for me was that a friend of mine from childhood was diagnosed with AIDS during this time period.
Not at a time when there was much perception of needed mercy for those who were suffering from that particular disease.
Absolutely not. It was a very tumultuous time, not unlike what we see today, actually, in some ways, a time of othering people.
Yes.
But this was someone I had known since he was 6 years old, and I knew he loved Jesus. I knew his family very well. He was 25 years old when he was diagnosed with AIDS. That Thanksgiving, I sat my whole family down, and we all agreed to take this time in our lives to devote to prayer for this particular friend. And I began my own personal exploration of what did that mean to be other than.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of confusion about AIDS at that time, and thousands of people being abandoned by family in their time of greatest need, and the aloneness that they felt and dealt with overwhelmed me.
Yeah.
I had grown up the daughter of a soldier killed in action. My father had died in Vietnam when I was 9. So grief was not unfamiliar to me. It was something I knew intimately.
Was it something, though, in this situation when you're extending to someone outside of your immediate family? You're an adult now.
Right.
Did the grief that you were working your way through an unexpected grief about your friend. Was it of the same substance as the grief of losing your father, or was there something that was new?
No, grief to me, it doesn't matter how you're losing somebody, whether that's even divorce, not just death. As we've all seen, there are all kinds of ways to grieve the loss of somebody. And so the grief to me was a familiar grief and an overwhelming one. And I just thought at that time, I read Steve Arterburn's book about his brother who died of AIDS. Excellent book. How Will I Tell My Mother? I think that's the name of the book.
I remember that.
She lived in Texas, and I called her and spoke to her. That's back when we had phone books. We could do that sort of thing.
Or 411.
Yeah, exactly. But I began a shift in thinking, whatever position we're taking as evangelicals, this cannot be right. Because it can't be that we treat people so inhumanely. This can't be God's call upon our life. To be unkind, looking at people in a way that says, well, you get what you deserve.
I'll get back to my special interview with Karen Zacharias in just a moment. But first, a quick reminder that it's your generosity and support that make Compassion Radio possible. Especially at a year like this, we need your vote of support. Call 1-800-868-2478. Write us at Compassion Radio, Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Or give online at CompassionRadio.com in order to keep this program coming to you each day. And hear me when I say this. We are very thankful for you, especially now. We have a very special thank you for your generous support to keep this ministry on the air and in the field. It's a fresh take on that amazing story of the life of Jesus, written by the Apostle John. We're calling it the Dynamic Gospel for a lot of reasons, and I'd love to send you one if you ask for it. Just let us know when you contact us today with your gift. And now, back to the interview.
Whatever position we're taking as evangelicals, this cannot be right. Because it can't be that we treat people so inhumanely. This can't be God's call upon our life. To be unkind, looking at people in a way that says, well, you get what you deserve.
Yeah. When our entire lens is about the sin we imagine them to have committed.
Exactly.
So how did that pivot or the softening for you play out?
Well, that's what I would consider my point of demarcation between moving away from an attitude that was extremely fundamentalist in nature, legalistic, judgmental, however you want to call it, to a period of realizing that I did not want to be a person who othered people.
Yes.
I had grown up in the 60s in Georgia. I had lived through integration. Busing happened in my high school when I was in my teens. All of that. You know, I didn't go to school with people of color until I was in high school. I was allowed to.
Yeah.
It was against the law. And I just couldn't believe that I was at that position. So there came this day when I sat on my porch in my rocking chair from Georgia.
Of course.
And I prayed. I was 38 years old at that time. And I said to God, there are two ways to age. You can age where your world gets smaller and smaller because you build more and more fences against the world. Or you can tear down those fences and live a life of faith and your world expands. I do not want to live a life of fear for the rest of my life, but I am afraid. I mean, I had all kinds of fears, a lot that had come out of that traumatic childhood I had been through. So I just prayed and asked God to open my world, to make it wider, and to bring me to a point of grace of embracing people that I had been so judgmental of.
the thing you're mentioning here, holding together both the I will not, I desire not, I do not ever want to live again or forever in fear, and I'm afraid, being existing in the same bowl. It sounds to me exactly like the man coming before Jesus saying, I do believe, help my unbelief. How can those things be so juxtaposed there?
I have prayed that prayer so many times, you have no idea. That's one of my go-to prayers, because honestly, my faith was easier when I was told what to think.
Indeed.
Than when I began to think for myself. There was a comfort in believing in all of that structure and all of those mandates. There was real insecurity that came with tearing down all of that, which, you know, just idols to me now.
Well, you think, how many times did it happen in the Old Testament where a prophet comes along and says, you really want the God you say you worship, you got to tear down the high places and all the Asherah poles and get rid of all those idols. Start with that. And the resistance comes with, but this is all we have. This is all the things we built.
Right.
My grandfather built that altar. I'm not tearing that down. And the nation paid the price time after time for it being unwilling to face their sins and the sins of their fathers. We see that all through the Old Testament.
Exactly.
And we see it now in the history of humanity, because it is a human condition issue. And of course, as far as it being falling short of the mark, it is the kind of sin that is original to any organized religion. And I've heard it said before, you can have religion or you can have Jesus. You got to choose. That seemed like a fairly trite thing to say, and very much for youth ministry and, you know, beach evangelism and that kind of stuff. But it's still a generational axiom. We have to face whether or not God himself is active now, wants to know me personally, and what is he calling us to be and to do? Every generation has got to do that, or they do not have a living faith. Sounds like you did it in probably the most lonely and dangerous place you could, in a comfortable Southern society where to change didn't seem to bring about or promise any good end for you. But you did it anyway. What happened next?
I will preface this by saying, when I personally came into a faith, it was through a Southern Baptist church. Mm-hmm. I always look at that church as a community who I say, love me to Jesus.
There you go.
They took the trailer park girl who was a partial orphan in many ways and loved me and did not judge me and did not ever make me feel rejected. And I, throughout my life, have had the benefit of having one really great loving pastor after another. I've benefited throughout my life from having wonderful pastors who understood the difference between a loving, gracious God and religion. And they did not push religion, but they embodied the love of Christ in their lives. And I benefited from having that model set before me. So I saw this movement in the 80s toward this othering of people, and I moved away from that. Did a lot of reading on my own. I did a lot of Bible study with my husband, and we made a conscious decision wanting to be the kind of people who chose to love and chose to open our home, which we did on numerous occasions, to the unconventional and saying, I never walked away from a traditional church structure, because church had always represented a safe haven for me, even though there have been times throughout this journey where church has not felt very much like a safe haven.
And this is a story, not just of outward bound and return, like a Ulysses journey. This is the cycle of family. I don't know of anybody that is really seeking God's heart, especially in the past few years, that has not been struggling with what does it really mean to be compassionate. And if I was to do those things that I read about in the New Testament, if I was to actually follow Jesus where he went, what would that do to my status or my place, my position within the church? Because there's a lot of people that I know that don't believe these things or don't act that way. Is there something wrong with me? Or is there something I'm not getting about the scripture? Or is there something that the church is missing? There's a lot of people struggling with that. And that, to me, as paradoxical as it sounds, is revival. This is God driving people back to his word to say, find me again. Not politically and not on a spectrum of politics, but in the pages of gospel. When you read the story that Jesus had his people write, the story that he lived that was recorded, you don't see him hanging out with the conventional. Everybody that is highlighted in the text seems to be somebody that has already been othered. His disciples were othered. The people he healed, the people that he loved on, the people that he touched and places he went that he was not supposed to go were all othered places. It seems to me that Jesus went out of his way in his entire lifetime to be with those who the rest of the world, the powers that be, considered less than. Would you read the scriptures that way too?
I absolutely see it that way. And of course, I think from my own personal experience, after my father died in Vietnam, I certainly felt less than. I mean, it wasn't common even in a military community to have other kids in class whose fathers died in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Because most of the men who died in Vietnam weren't old enough to have had kids.
That's true.
So there was always feeling like I wasn't like other people. And so I had an appreciation for what that meant to be on the other side of that. But I also knew from that church in Georgia that had loved me to Jesus, how love could transform, how love could provide community, how accepting other people where they're at and trusting God to deal with grace in their lives and for me not to have to make those decisions for them, but to trust that a loving, merciful God would and can has the power to transform and transcend people's lives.
And you did that even as someone who is outside the nuclear family. You would expect a parent, no matter how wayward the child has gone, to, on paper at least, be obligated to love them no matter what. So if they've gone to prison or done some horrendous thing and they've been othered by the rest of the world, you expect the family at least to stand by them as compassionately as a family should. And they would go beyond anything we would do because it's their child.
Right.
But when you start doing that across the lines of nuclear families and you, Karen, and your family start taking in people that everyone else has turned out, how did you deal with that and the repercussions within your community or your culture where you lived in the South for doing such a thing?
Well, I will just say I'm dealing with it still. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm beyond that yet. Certainly, we've been through some really challenging years recently where I continue to seek and say, is this how we should do this? Is this really God's call upon our people to treat one another with such disrespect? Is God really calling us to be a people that bullies and demeans and denigrates other people? I mean, family members.
Yeah.
True blood family members at odds with each other. I come from a long line of Appalachian people who are very proud, but very caring. And I always go back to my dad's mom, my granny Leona, who was one of the kindest, most Christian women I've ever met. Even though as a crippled woman, she wasn't going to church. She had no way to get there. She was handicapped, and that was an issue. And yet she began each day with that Bible on her lap and with the name of Jesus on her lips. She would never treat anybody without dignity.
I hope you've been moved so far by the story of Karen Zacharias. We cover much more in the days to come, so I hope you'll tune in then and drop by our website for the podcast. In the meantime, you can learn more about Karen's books and projects at KarenZach.com. That's Karen, ZACH.com. There's no doubt that trying times bring out the best and the worst in mankind. I'm praying that God will bring out the very best of Him in you today. Thank you for standing with Compassion Radio in times like this. I think you know that we're a unique voice in Christian radio. Your generosity and your faith in us make it possible for us to continue doing what we do each and every day. On our Monday broadcast, we've been highlighting the book of John and our special edition of that dynamic gospel. It's our special thank you for your support of Compassion Radio in this critically important time. I'd love to send you a copy. Just let us know you'd like one when you give today. Please call us today to let us know you're standing with us. The number is 1-800-868-2478. That's 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is Compassion Radio, P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Again, Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Of course, you can reach us 24/7 at CompassionRadio.com. There you'll find more information about the projects we do, the places we go, and the ways you can get involved today. That's CompassionRadio.com. Thanks again for joining us, and please join us again for the rest of this special series with author Karen Zacharias. Remember, if you missed any of today's interview or would like to share it with a friend, just head over to CompassionRadio.com and click the broadcast link in the menu. We'll see you tomorrow.